it is very easy to just be driven by the urgent, to let a growing city get away from you in terms of planning and infrastructure development, to not get the equity considerations right in terms of building cities that work for everyone, and to let the financial model of cities get into a situation where it's unsustainable and therefore you can't invest and you can't do the sort of cross subsidies that you need for an equitable city.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. A decade ago, a drought in Cape Town meant the city was within days of running out of water. Today, the city uses data to make sure that a crisis like this can never happen again for any of Cape Town's essential services, but additionally, that the city can make the best use of its resources. Hugh Cole, the Director of Policy and Strategy for the City of Cape Town, is at the heart of this operation. He joins me now. Hugh, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks very much, Tim. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Hugh, Cape Town's drought is in history now, but I vividly remember the news reports.
Cape Town is running out of water. After 3 years of unprecedented drought, it could be the first major city in the world to go dry.
How severely was Cape Town's water supply affected by the drought?
Tim, I actually joined the city of Cape Town right in the thick of the drought. And so it's also very, very vivid in my memory. It was very much jumping straight into the furnace of a very stressful situation. Mm-hmm. So it was a 1 in 400 year drought, a very extreme climate event. And it was 3 to 4 years of extremely low rainfall. So it started in 2015, and by 2018, dam levels had dropped to 20%. After that, we had some good rains and things started to recover. And just to give you a sense of how severe 20% is, the last 10% of the dam's capacity is very difficult to use, to the point where people would say it's unusable.
Right.
For emergency planning, we had set a trigger for escalating to the next phase of the crisis response and starting to shut down parts of the reticulation network. And that trigger was 13.5% dam capacity. We got pretty close.
It's like a Hollywood thriller, isn't it? And day zero is basically the day at which you run out of water.
Yeah, it was an interesting term that we came up in the media and then became actually part of the communications of the city because it was just what people were relating to. And originally meant the day that there was literally no water left at all.
Yeah.
And it then became known as the day when we would reach that 13.5% threshold. And we would begin to have to turn off some parts of the network. And that would mean that some residents would have to use water collection points. So it coalesced around that 13.5% point. And the plan was to begin to shut down parts of the network where it would have caused less economic input, or it would have been less affected more vulnerable communities less. So that, you know, it was done with a sort of vulnerability lens. But day zero was at 13.5%.
Well, you certainly picked your time to join once in 400 years. You. As this needle ticked down, what policies were being used, I guess, to try and put off day zero?
As you can imagine, Tim, we threw everything at the problem. But there were a variety of tools used. So there was an effort to create emergency supply. So that was through water sharing agreements with the farmers, it was through, you know, aquifers and emergency desal plants, etc. So there was a stream of work on that, a lot of work on demand management. And that included steep tariff increases, water management devices, which would cut off at above a certain level of usage or turn to a trickle above a certain level of usage, a heavy communications campaign, and then really importantly from an engineering perspective, pressure management in the network. Now, because as you will appreciate, Tim, when you throw everything at a problem, it's difficult to then ex post pass out exactly which element had the biggest effect. I think the accepted insight now is that probably the most two effective elements were the communication, so working with residents to drive down demand, and then the pressure management in the network, because that reduced leaks, it reduced the amount of water that came up the tap every time someone opened it. And the consensus seems to be that those are the two most effective components.
This must have been a hugely stressful event for everybody involved. Is this something that is unique about the nature of Cape Town, or Could this water crunch happen in other cities in Africa?
Cape Town is a winter rainfall area, so we have to collect all our water in the winter, and we rely on a series of dams in the mountains near Cape Town, which we share with other municipalities. And so there is some vulnerability there in that the dam capacity wouldn't last us for as many years as some other cities in the world. Maybe they have bigger dam capacity. But the truth is, Tim, that other cities have faced this. So it absolutely has happened elsewhere and will happen elsewhere in the future. Mexico City and Bogota had severe water crisis in 2024. Sao Paulo had a very severe crisis in 2014. And then Chennai also was a city that effectively did run out of water. And I understand now that this is a very serious issue in Tehran. It is something that we have seen in the past and will see into the future in cities across the world.
As you said, there was a 3-4 year drought as well. But contributing to this is urbanization. You need more water, the process of development. There are more water-intensive things going on. Can we attribute some of this to climate change?
African cities have growing populations. Cape Town has a population growth of 3% a year, but that rate of population growth is much bigger in some other African cities. You have aging network infrastructure. You've got the challenge of maintaining aging infrastructure, often in the historical core of the city. Then you've got a rapidly expanding city, and so you need to also build new capacity. And then you've got competing demands for what bulk infrastructure you invest in. So do you invest in roads? Do you invest in sewage? Do you invest in water capacity? Mm-hmm. You've got lots of hard choices to make on the investment front. And even just that would be a challenge. So how to sustain a growing city and manage all of those dynamics across all the utilities that are needed to enable the city. And then you layer on climate change over the top of it. And climate change definitely, there's been very robust scientific investigations done on the Cape Town drought, and the consensus is that it was made more severe and more likely by climate change. And that is certainly, when we look at our projections for Cape Town, is that we anticipate that because we're a winter rainfall region and the climate models are not 100% clear, but the things that we're certain of is a long-term drying trend is likely. We're going to have more extreme weather events. So we'll have, ironically, both a high risk of flooding and of drought, and then more high heat days, more storm surges and high wind events. So those, you know, those are the realities we face. And those cities across the continent are going to face similar extremes that they then have to cope, adapt to, and plan for on top of the normal challenges of a rapidly growing city.
Must be very thankful that this particular crisis is in the rearview mirror now, but it's not like anyone thinks that this could never happen again. So immediately after the crisis, what did Cape Town put in place to give it the insights to avoid this repeating, and what was your role in all of this?
After the crisis, we put in place a water strategy that reset our vision for the city in terms of water. So that's been a guiding strategy for all of our utility reforms and our investments since then. Mm-hmm. So there was that strategy clarification component. There was then a process of committing to developing options for water augmentation. So that was aquifers and investment in non-surface water options. So we're pursuing public-private partnerships for desalination and water reuse. And then there was a very serious effort. We still publish very openly a dashboard around water usage and dam levels. Mm-hmm. And the interest in those goes up or down, depending on what's happening with the rainfall season. But, you know, if we've had a relatively dry winter, like the one we're just in at the moment in Cape Town, then there's a lot of interest in that water dashboard. And then we've revisited our drought alert levels so that they're simpler and easier to communicate. And then we've thought about how we structure the income of the water utility so that it can be sustainable. Because one of the things that we've seen is that consumption trends have changed, and that has impacted on our financial model, and we've had to adapt to that. But one of the big things we've carried on doing is pushing into the use of data to inform what we do. For example, I mentioned pressure management as being key to the drought response. through that process of trying to manage the pressure zones in the city, we realized that actually over time, those zones become compromised because, you know, pipes are added and not necessarily recorded exactly how it affects the pressure zone, et cetera. So there was a very comprehensive exercise done of remapping those pressure zones and understanding exactly what was going on within those pressure zones and water going into a zone versus water coming out, and making sure that it's something that our engineers call zonal water balance assessment. So that's been a very intensive data exercise that is ongoing and is one of the things that will help us navigate the next drought when it comes. And then actually not long after was COVID.
Yes.
And we took the lessons from the drought in terms of how we responded, and we built that into our COVID response. We took a really strong program management approach to how we responded to COVID. And then we put the data team right at the center of that response. From the drought and in COVID, we learned critical lessons on the use of data. Particularly the COVID one actually shifted the culture around how the leadership makes decisions and the expectations around data and how data should inform decision making. We've carried that forward into all of our work across the city.
This sounds like a very data-intensive exercise to be able to not only produce all these numbers, but to keep them updated so that people are looking at what's going on now rather than what happened 3 months or 6 months ago. And also, is it mainly for water now? Is it for all the resources of a city? Because there are many essential services keep a city running.
It's for all the services of the city. And there's something about the city that people who don't work with cities every day might not realize, but cities' governments are structured so differently everywhere in the world. And so it's worth saying in Cape Town that we have all of our utilities are in-house under one roof. So they're not privatized utilities. We don't have a separate roads agency or a property development agency. It's all under one government. As we've driven our use of data and we put in place a data strategy and a core data capability, we've been able to drive that use of data across all the different parts of the city. And engineers who've planned water networks or energy networks have always used data to do their work. And it's just about supplementing that and taking it to the next level. And then taking active data use into parts of the business that may not have used it to the same extent in the past. So it applies to everything we do, whether it be one of the utilities of waste, water and sanitation or energy, or whether it be our safety and security work or our emergency services work, or planning for the spatial plan of the city or housing, or the planning for recreational facilities, or the management of our capital portfolio. The way we do program management and capital portfolio management is very data intensive.
That dashboard that people will be very engaged with, especially during a crisis, how much do you disaggregate the data? Is it saying this is the state of the whole city of Cape Town, or is it more this is what's happening here and this is what's happening over here?
So for that particular dashboard, the one I had in mind, it's a citywide view. But during the drought, there was a very innovative piece of work done with some academic partners, including Martin Visser at the University of Cape Town, to develop a map around water consumption. You go to the map and see your neighborhood, and you could see a green dot to see if certain neighborhoods were within their water usage limits. And it was aimed to create some sort of positive peer pressure within neighborhoods for people to get within the water constraints. So we have the ability to get very granular with data whilst protecting personal information and respecting our South African version of the GDPR regulations in Europe.
When you are collecting data, of course, we're used to seeing data on reservoir levels, things like that. You're collecting far more data. It sounds like a lot of this data just always existed. It's just never been used in a strategy before. Is that correct?
It's a good observation. I think of us in four categories. So I think there's administrative data. There's official statistics, for want of a better phrase, I'll call it collected data. And then one that I call high frequency alternative data. And so let's start with admin data. To run a billing system for a city, you have to understand what is the value of the property, and therefore what is a property tax on that property. And then you have to have a system for billing for that. Likewise, if you're going to charge for water and sanitation, you have to understand how much water it was used, and therefore you both are the same with energy, et cetera. So all of those systems are very data intensive. And I think in the past for us, and I think it's true of many governments, that data tended to be used for a single purpose. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's a generalization, but I think it's broadly true. Often data were collected for a single purpose, and it was very much seen as the entity that was primarily responsible for that function. It was their data. They owned it, and it's not for others to use. It's my responsibility to look after this data, and it can't be used willy-nilly. So one of the main shifts that we had in the city with the data strategy was actually to say, actually, if data are collected using public money, then it should be used as a public resource, and it should be used to solve whatever problems need to be solved across the city. So that's admin data. So you're absolutely right. Many of those data sets were always collected, but they were used for a very narrow purpose. And so the journey has been about thinking about how we can use those more widely. And then I think the element of the journey for us on admin data has been on access to the data. So we're very fortunate that we have a single unified ERP system across the city, but a 20, 25-year-old ERP system doesn't necessarily always meet the needs of modern data analytics. And so there's a significant effort that goes into data engineering to get the data out in the form that you need it to do the analytics. And on official statistics, we have a very good national statistics agency, and it have been some challenges recently, and there were challenges with the last census that was done, which meant that certain components of the census weren't released, and that's very costly or is a big disadvantage. But putting that aside, in the national statistics gathering never goes to the level of granularity that we needed for city planning. Mm-hmm. So if they're doing a metro level sample, it's a good enough sample to give a metro view, but it's never going to tell us what's happening in this suburb versus that suburb, or this income group versus that income group. And those are the sort of level of detail you need to make good decisions. We leverage official statistics, whether that be employment surveys or labor force surveys or crime stats, all of those things we will leverage. And we work very closely with national government to try and improve access to data that informs our decision making. We really appreciate the work that's been done to make spatialized tax data available to researchers and city governments, which has helped a lot with knowing where employment is in the city. But the, you know, official statistics are important, but they have their limitations. So we've then gone to the next one, which is collected data, which is designing our own survey. So we run a household survey. We're aiming for 10,000 households. We want to do it every 2 to 3 years. And then we also do other surveys that are very focused on specific things. So we do a travel survey, and we do an annual customer satisfaction survey. And then the last one is the more experimental component, which is recognizing that the private sector is collecting data on what's going on in the city and often has far more insight, actually, at a far higher level of granularity and frequency than we would have. So how can we partner with the private sector in a way that it respects privacy and is completely compliant with our data protection and privacy protection laws, but gives us insights into what's going on? One example is working with a private sector partner that was able to give us insights through their data collection on migration. Because for our population projections, and population projections, is, some people say a city's demography is destiny, you know, same for countries. So you have to understand what's coming down the track so that you can plan for it properly. If you bring in a good actuary, they can nail the births and deaths side of it, the natural growth. But the part that is very uncertain in our context is migration. And through partnering with this private sector partner, we were able to get numbers we're very, very confident in on net migration. And also net migration, including a sense of income level, which is really important for us. So that we're able to understand, are the people coming in who will be moving to Cape Town able to pay for services or not? And that helps us to plan for the future. And I think that there's much more that we can do with banks and financial institutions that service particularly the informal economy, because we're very aware that if, you know, like me, I live in a formal house. I license my vehicle through the city. The city has pretty good data on me. I'm very visible to the city. But someone who lives in an informal settlement and uses informal paratransit and works in the informal sector is much less visible. We're exploring the options for working with other partners in banking and telcos to get better insights on what's happening in the informal economy in a way that's aggregated and anonymized. Of course, we don't have personal information that we should not have.
I note that you also work with JPL Water, Air and Energy Lab. I think that's what it's called. What is the project there? What's their role?
This is a collaboration between JPL Africa, which is based at the University of Cape Town, and ourselves, the City of Cape Town. And it's to co-generate research and then to inform the scaling of evidence-based programs and policies that improve access to clean air, water, and reliable energy. So the idea is obviously it must be focused on benefiting the residents of Cape Town first and foremost, but the goal is also to generate knowledge that can be used elsewhere and is relevant elsewhere. You know, we recently had the opportunity at a gathering in London as part of London Climate Week to connect with the other partners that are part of this global initiative founded by JPL and community Jamil. And I was able to meet the equivalent labs from Egypt and India. And the Egyptian one is a national lab, the Indian one is a state level lab. And so it was really interesting to compare notes as to our data challenges and the sort of topics that we are tackling through research to inform policymaking.
This is only fascinating, but I know that these data science and data collection initiatives can often be extremely hard to then turn into insight. Are there things that you would point to now that you say, we were able to achieve that because of what we're doing here, and we could not have done that without this initiative?
I'll give you specific examples in a second, but sort of more generalized observation I'd say is that obviously when you're trying to understand causality and you really want to be precise and understanding what exactly is going on with a particular policy challenge, you know, the gold standard is to do a randomized control trial. But randomized control trials are demanding in terms of their specification and the ability to randomize the interventions, and they take time to set up. So the Water, Air and Energy Lab is RCT-based, but what's been great working with our research partners, they have brought in advice along the way. And even like, for example, collecting data, cleaning up and doing descriptive statistics, it's part of the research process. But for us as policymakers, it's valuable now. And that has been one of the many things we've really appreciated. And for example, in this lab that we actually have the initiative funds a data engineer who sits in our data analytics hub and helps with the accessing and processing of data. Now, once you've cleaned up a data set and got access, you've automated the data flow, it's very helpful for the research team, but it also is helpful for our internal analytics, and it helps us to service the decision makers better. So there's a project on free basic electricity, and that is around the optimization of free basic electricity allocation. So in the South African context, there are the customers who pay for electricity and the customers who are not able to pay for services, including electricity. And so we have a free basic electricity a subsidy to low-income households, and it's targeted at those with low property values and low electricity usage. And that's a significant fiscal transfer and one that we have within city government powers. It doesn't depend on grant regimes run by the National Treasury. There's a very important question there is, are our subsidies reaching the right households, A, and what effect are they actually having on energy use and household well-being? Because we're going to be spending money on subsidizing those who need free basic services. Let's make sure it's reaching the right people and having the effect that we think it's having. And what makes this project possible is something quite specific about how the Cape Town is structured, its targeting. So because those subsidies are allocated using clear eligibility thresholds, households just in above and below those cutoffs are in most respects very similar. And that creates a rare opportunity to measure the causal effect of the subsidy rather than just observing a correlation. So the electricity team in the city has been involved in this right from the start. And we're learning a lot already from the preliminary results of that about subsidy targeting. And even just the conversation around this project is helping to advance the thinking in the city around the subsidies. So the second project we're doing is there is an initiative partly coming out of the droughts on advanced metering infrastructure, realizing that being able to put in AMIs, basically electronic metering that has a digital interface. And we're doing it for lots of reasons. It's to improve billing accuracy, to improve revenue recovery, but there's also a behavior change components to that. Mm-hmm. And so we're interested in questions like, does installing those meters improve billing accuracy and revenue recovery? Does it affect consumer water use behavior, particularly when customers receive more frequent and detailed consumption information? So, you know, I don't have one of those meters. I get billing water consumption information at the end of the month. It's hard to adjust my behavior if I'm getting monthly information. And then, you know, also can it improve leak detection? Because a big issue in South Africa, and it's actually a big issue across the continent, is non-revenue water, so water loss to leaks in particular. And then you want to try and separate out those sort of hard infrastructure effects from the behavioral effects. We're rolling out these water meters. We could have just done it and then told ourselves a story afterwards about, you know, if it was very successful, it was definitely our superior insight and planning as a city government that had that wonderful effect. And if it didn't work out, we'd blame it on something else. But there was a great opportunity here to roll those meters out in a phased way because there's a constraint on how many houses the contractor can access in a month. There's a budget limitation. We can't fund all the meters in a year. It was a phased rollout, and that creates the opportunity for randomization and for us to be able to study the effect.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then the last one that I give an example of is one that's kind of in the formation, so it hasn't started yet, is around minibus taxi reform. So, you know, a key issue all over the world, developing country context, let me say, is how do you get paratransit to perform better because it's such a big part of public transport in developing country cities. And that is also a very big issue in Cape Town and in South Africa is, you know, minibus taxis are essential to moving people around the city. But there is reform needed. We do need to improve road safety. We do need to improve the efficiency of that. And so we've got a reform program that's very orientated around collaboration with the industry and very data intensive. We're working with research partners both to inform the program design in terms of learning from what else works elsewhere in the world, but then also to put in place an evaluation strategy so that we can understand which components of the program are having an effect.
But why these questions? Why billing and subsidies?
There's an important point to make here that we can think about the adaptation to climate change and supply of good quality utility services in cities as big macro questions. But I think often the distributional effects don't get carefully thought about enough. And Ed Glaser, you know, has one of his great examples he always uses is around the provision of clean water in New York and how people were still dying of cholera after clean water was provided to New York because of the incentives for landlords to connect to the water supply. And that's a great historical example. Those sort of challenges are alive today in the cities of the developing world. And that's why understanding distributional effects and incentives is really important. And then the other thing is, I just don't think that there's enough attention paid to the financial sustainability of utilities. So for example, in South Africa, there's a big focus on the just energy transition and transitioning away from coal-fired power and a lot of thinking about what needs to happen there and tariff reform structures at a national level, breaking up the national energy monopoly, et cetera, et cetera. But outside of Cape Town and maybe a few others, many of the utilities, energy utilities at a local level are in financial distress. And you can't think about energy transitions and those other goals if you're not also thinking about the utilities' sustainable finances, which means that you have to think about how tariffs are structured in a way that's financially sustainable and equitable in terms of poverty alleviation.
So I imagine there's many researchers listening to this at the moment and thinking, that is some really exciting data, some really interesting possibilities for research here. But in that collaboration between researchers and yourselves, then obviously who gets access to what data is always something you have to be careful about and be mindful of. How does that work in practice?
We have a formal research application process, and they can apply to do research with the city. And we get over 100 research projects that we facilitate every year. Now, the spectrum of those is wide. You know, it's like master's students wanting to do access some data or do some interviews for their master's thesis, through to PhD students, and then, of course, you know, very accomplished researchers of the likes that we work closely with at GCT, like I mentioned, Martin Fisser, but, you know, Kelsey Jack and Nick Savanides and several others that we work intensively with. So that's one way that researchers can get access to data. And then for researchers who we're working very closely with, we have a way of sharing data. We've jointly developed with research partners, in particular with Kelsey Jack, a data sharing platform that allows us to control the sharing of data in a very well-governed way, but that makes data accessible to researchers without them having to walk in to a government building, make friends with the person who runs the revenue data system, and then like stick in a memory stick or a device and download a whole bunch of data and walk out the city. You know, we haven't done that way, but that does happen a lot in governments around the world. It's not efficient for the researcher. It's not good data protection practice. And so we said, let's build a channel for us to be able to share data in a well-governed way with trusted researchers who've been through the approval process. So we have the approval process, we have this sort of ability to share data efficiently with trusted research partners, and then we have the open data portal. So those are the broad brushstrokes of how we go about collaborating with external researchers.
Now, when you're creating these insights from the data that you have, there is still an extra step. You still have to decide what policies are appropriate for Cape Town to put into place. Is that a process that you take part in, or is your job to provide the evidence to policymakers?
It is a process that I take part in and my team takes part in. So obviously, there are certain categories of decision which really are in the realm of council-approved policy. So our city government is a democratically elected council, and the mayor will take key policy decisions to the council for consideration and approval. So there's a category of policy which is very much ultimately in the political domain because it has to be made, rightly so, by the people who were elected by the public to represent them. And then there's a category of policymaking that's more administrative, and I'm involved in both. So I wear two hats in my job. One is I'm director of policy and strategy, So my team runs the annual 5-year and 25-year strategic planning process for the year, mm-hmm. for the city. And then we also work on the conversion of that strategy into infrastructure strategy. We also run the policy process for the city so that there's a properly governed policy process that is, you know, starts with a concept note and goes all the way through to the policy, internal, external policy being approved. And we run that process, but we also do a lot of content development, particularly on high-profile policy instruments, such as the one we've just that's out for public comments at the moment in response to short-term letting, a new short-term letting bylaw. And then we have the research team that partners with JPAL, and then we have a data analytics hub and an economics team. So those component parts of the team all work together to inform policymaking. And so we're involved in presenting evidence, helping to interpret it, responding to requests for new evidence, and then also just working through the policy process. And sometimes that will look like the proposal being given to us by the mayor, for example, or it'll be the mayor saying, I want a solution to this problem, and then we'll develop options and then go through an iterative policy development process. And so there's an engagement for my team sits in the sort of corporate center, but we always have to work with the domain experts and the people who have authority. So like in water and sanitation, there'll be water and sanitation experts, and there'll be an executive director who's responsible for that function. So we work very closely with them and then with the political principals in that policy process.
Now, I asked you if the challenges facing Cape Town were unique to Cape Town, and your answer was pretty decisively no. Is the solution that you've put in place, this work that you're doing, is that something that other cities that are facing similar challenges can adopt, should adopt?
Every city and country is different, and everything has to be context specific. We've built what we've built and learning from others. You know, we've sought to copy what we've seen elsewhere. And I was previous at the International Growth Center and had the opportunity to work in the space between researchers and policymakers across sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. I brought a lot of what I saw there into my role in the city government. The short answer to your question is, I think, yes, there are things that are transferable to other contexts. So, for example, having a well-governed policy process that brings evidence in as one of the core components of the process is absolutely transferable to any other context. I think the lessons we've learned about creating our data strategy, strategies don't ever solve problems on their own. You know, they can very easily sit on shelf, mm-hmm. as you know. But the lesson of the role of the strategy in setting direction, getting the process of getting everyone on board with that, is transferable. Then the lessons we've learned around building an internal data and analytics team and the approach we took there of being capability-led and not procurement-led. You know, we didn't lead, we weren't reliant on vendors and consultants. We built internal capacity, and how we went about building that capacity is something that I think is adaptable. Likewise, building our own, you know, one of the early conversations I had with Tony Venables and Ed Glazer when I first was moving into this job is I asked their advice. If you could get the economics team in the city of Cape Town to do one thing, what would you do? And they were like, well, do cost-benefit analysis on everything and then build evaluation capacity. That's one of the things we did. And we built that cost-benefit analysis capability. And on the drought topic we started with, Tim, you know, we made sure that that cost-benefit analysis capability is applied to those investment decisions and that we bring in climate change into that cost-benefit analysis. Those are things that are transferable as well, Tim.
If you're going to ask two people for advice, that's not a bad two people to pick, is it?
Indeed.
Hugh, what is the risk in urban environments if this type of work is not done, if this sort of analysis is not performed in future?
Ed Glazer is very compelling and inspiring on the promise of cities. And he talks about there's no pathway from poverty to prosperity that does not run through city mm-hmm. streets. And then he talks about, particularly in thinking about Africa, about, you know, how the cities of Africa have yet to be built. And so there's this urgent challenge to get those right, to get the planning and the foundations for those cities right. And if we get them right, we will allow the flourishing of millions and millions, billions of people. And we will also enable better response to climate change and more climate change mitigation and adaptation. So much is potentially to be gained by getting the cities of the developing world and the cities of Africa to thrive. But it is very easy to just be driven by the urgent, to let a growing city get away from you in terms of planning and infrastructure development, to not get the equity considerations right in terms of building cities that work for everyone, and to let the financial model of cities get into a situation where it's unsustainable and therefore you can't invest and you can't do the sort of cross-subsidies that you need for an equitable city. So often in government in general, not just in cities, Tim, we confuse correlation for causation. We implement programs, and then if they work in government, we say that was definitely us. And if it didn't work, it was definitely someone else's fault. And I just think we want to avoid making those basic mistakes as we go about planning cities. And then I think the last thing I'd say, Tim, is I think because cities are so heavily reliant on infrastructure, something I've been thinking about a lot recently is the need to figure out which long-term infrastructure decisions you can make with agility. You can adjust the plan. You should have things in the pipeline. You know what the city needs, but there's certain types of infrastructure you can adjust. Like an electricity network, you can adjust reasonably quickly. But there's certain infrastructure types, which in our context will take at least 7 to 8 years to prepare. And you have to know enough about the future of your city, but to be able to make some big hard calls about those big investments and then commit to them, you know, 8-10 years out. Because if you don't do that, you won't prepare for the city of the future. If you don't have that ability to plan for the future, to figure out which are the most important things, and to know how long it's going to take you to prepare those projects and then commit to them early and differentiate those from the ones that you can be flexible on, I think that's also a huge risk.
Thank you very much, Hugh, and good luck with your work.
Thanks very much, Tim.
For further reading, I've got a couple of papers to recommend to you. Dodging Day Zero, Drought Adaptation and Inequality in Cape Town, authors Alexander Abagian, Cassandra Cole, Kelsey Jack Colming, and Martin Visser, published in 2025. And also, City of Cape Town, South Africa, Aligning Internal Data Capabilities with External Research Partnerships. That's very on the nose for what we've been talking about. Authors Hugh Cole, Kelsey Jack, Derek Strong, and Brendan Morn Brown. That was published in 2020 in the Handbook on Using Administrative Data for Research and Evidence-Based Policy. And if you want a little bit more of Hugh, then there is an IGC video from 2020, Building City Resilience, Data Lessons from Cape Town, which is a short summary of the sorts of things we've been talking about. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. There is a new episode every Wednesday, so when you follow the show, you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. You'll never miss one. Past episodes, always at voxdev.org. Articles on the topics we cover there as well. And we link to those topics in the show notes too. If you like what you hear, tell someone about us and leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zalgarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.